Live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios in New York City. We have an extraordinarily information-loaded program today. Of course, starting always with the latest on health and healing and anti-aging information. But also today, after watching, this morning while I was in the gym working out early, and I was watching the MSNBC program about these experts talking about our health insurance problems in the United States. And they want to keep with Obamacare, maybe tweak it a bit, but they like it. And they don't like anything that would be proposed, though they're not sure what would be proposed from Trump and his advisors. I believe that for at least the last 30 years, we've had absolutely everything wrong about health care. One of our biggest mistakes is politicizing it. So today I'll be doing a commentary with specific facts and documentation showing you that everything we've been told about our healthcare system is wrong. And if we really want to help people and make sure they're covered, then we have to have a special type of universal healthcare. And when you lay it out in a reasonable and responsible way with actual documentation, you take all of your biases and ideologies out of it, and you just see it for what it is, it's, most people say, yeah, it makes sense. I'll share it with you. Then I'm going to have a commentary called The Russians Did Not Do It by Gregory Barrett of Fearless Muckraking, as well as Dealing with the Environment, a commentary from Chris Hedges from Truthdig, We Cannot Fight Climate Change If We Keep Lying to Ourselves. And then my guest in the second part of our program is Dr. Jack Rasmus. And we're going to talk about what we're not talking about anywhere, bubbles. And these bubbles are worse than they were in 2007 and 8. And they're here now. The debt is just unimaginable. I've gotten the latest figures for you. Our figures are accurate. You will not hear these figures on any other media. But because we have scholars in residence, because we value scholarship and accuracy, you'll hear some terrifying reality figures today. But you need to know that, so at least you know where we're at. And then I'm going to also, if time permits, I'm going to address the current misinformation that's out there about coconut oil. I've been inundated by people saying, Gary, I thought coconut oil was good, but the mainstream media, the American Heart Association, is saying it doesn't do anything for us. Well, that's their opinion. Now, I won't show you opinion. I'll show you the actual scientific peer-reviewed literature showing that coconut oil is terrific for you. Remember, about once or twice a year, every year, they throw one of these straw men out and then beat it, like it was vitamin C, it can cause cancer. Well, we showed that it wasn't true. Even the study they were citing said it didn't cause cancer. And then they said the GMOs were equal to organic. Then we showed you the multiple studies that organic is richer in nutrients, not even debating the issue of what it does to the environment. So every year, we'll take it on. Right now, it's going to be today, coconut oil. So don't panic because you read something in your newspaper. Let's begin. We have a lot to share. Glutamine is an important nutrient. It's one that most people don't get. And generally, when people hear glutamine, you're thinking, well, okay, malabsorption syndrome. People have been eating wrong foods for a long period of time, so their body's not really absorbing a lot. Or they may have leaky gut syndrome, which means that because of pressure, what are called pressure diseases, generally from constipation, forcing the body to move the mass of dead cells, bacteria, and undigested leucocytes through, you end up causing tiny little holes in the intestine or colon to which bacteria and undigested food gets in, and that causes an immediate immune reaction, and it's very unhealthy, which is one of the reasons a lot of people are very unhealthy. They have poor digestion. They have bad bacteria. They don't have good digestional health. So glutamine is brought in. It's generally number one, 2,000-4,000 milligrams. But now from the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease, published in the Journal of Clinical Investigation, there is something else it does, and this is good. Glutamine suppresses herpes in this study. Glutamine supplementation can suppress reactivation of herpes simplex virus in this laboratory study. The research was conducted by scientists at the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease, part of the National Institutes of Health. So that's good. So if you have herpes, now a lot of people would be taking a lysine, 5,000 to 10,000 milligrams, and the same amount of vitamin C. Now adding maybe 3,000 milligrams of glutamine. Also, another study, this is from St. George's University in London, and it says the following. Cannabis in the oil form kills leukemia cells. Oh, so this is, by the way, there are thousands of studies on the medicinal value of cannabis, and generally the cannabinoids, which are the essential oils, these are not the same oils that create the spaciness and the marijuana high, but these are very powerful in the brain. They help with epilepsy, seizures, stroke, brain cancer, all good. So this has confirmed yet another positive use of cannabis. And we've known for a long time that cannabis has been able to kill cancer cells. There are several studies on that. But the new revelation regarding leukemia is important because the disease is a cancer of bone marrow and other blood-forming organs. The study, which was led by Dr. Walu of St. George University in London, the team studied cancer cells and tested a variety of combinations of chemotherapy and drugs, and then they tested the cannabinoids in order to find the most effective grouping, and there it was, cannabinoids. So put that on your, if you have leukemia, put that on your treatment list. Get a doctor who knows the scientific literature. You can pull it up yourself. You can go to PubMed and then type in leukemia or whatever cancer you have, prostate cancer, brain cancer, breast cancer, and cannabinoids, the research. It'll show you all the studies that can give you better insight on how it is manifested and what proof there is that it works. It was interesting. I was counseling a terminally ill person yesterday, and they had gone through a bout of chemotherapy and radiation for colorectal cancer. And so when I said, you checked the scientific literature before you allowed yourself to be given this therapy, that no, why not? I trusted the doctor. I'm not an expert. The oncologist is. So if an oncologist and radiologist both tell you that you need a particular therapy, who am I to say otherwise? I said, well, it's the scientific literature. Google colorectal cancer, therapeutic treatments, and then positive and negative effects. And you won't find that the chemotherapy used was beneficial. Well, it wasn't beneficial because now the cancer's back, the immune system's shot, and now the person's at an end stage. So got to help him rebalance, rebuild. The difference is I try to give people the actual scientific literature. So I say, don't take my word for it. Do your homework, and here are some studies to show that this particular way of approaching it can help you. But I believe we should do that with every medical procedure, every single one. And also, this is from Peking University. It's about treating autism by targeting the gut. Quote, experts have called the large-scale studies into altering the makeup of bacteria in the gut after a review showed that this might reduce the symptoms of autism spectrum disorder. Until now, caregivers have relied upon rehabilitation, educational interventions, and drugs to reduce its symptoms, but now researchers suggested that treating this condition could be as simple as changing their diet. A review of more than 150 scientific papers on autism spectrum disorder and gut bacteria found that since the 1960s, Scientists have been reporting links between composition of bacteria in the gut and autistic behavior. Quote, to date, there is no effective therapies to treat this range of brain developmental disorders. The number of people being diagnosed with autism spectrum disorders on the rise, as well as being an expensive condition to manage. And autism spectrum disorder has a huge emotional and social cost on families and sufferers. Well, I agree that there has been a lot of association between gut bacteria, the probiotics that create that, and showing improvement. They are wrong when they say there is no effective treatment. There's a young man. His name is Jonathan Ortega. His mother and father, both retired New York City police officers, and by the way, told me they never had to unholster their guns in 20-some years on the force. One would work night, one would work day, because when you have a son who has autism spectrum disorder at the far end of that range, meaning emotional outbursts, repetitive behavior, and they get so big they can then become a danger to themselves or others. And he was on 4 antipsychotic medications and was suggested he have a 5th, and the mother said no more. And that's when she heard me on the radio on WBAI in New York and tried therapy, and it stopped the seizures, then went further than that, and then went the whole therapy. Today, I'm happy to say that Jonathan is completely healthy, completely normal, and in college and was at the high end of his class. In fact, I took Jonathan and his parents, along with a woman who I helped reverse her end-stage Alzheimer's. And by the way, tomorrow, you're going to, I promise every week to have someone on that has been successfully relieved of conditions that medicine is not able to change the outcome of. And you will hear a woman tomorrow. So if you know anyone who has advanced Alzheimer's, have them listen tomorrow. Because tomorrow at noon, you will hear a woman who would be dead now, who is alive and improving. And you hear from family members about the remarkable turnaround once this woman started the protocol. Anyhow, I went to a scientific conference. There were somewhere between 3,000 and 7,000 scientists. And these are very boring events. You go in, you present a paper, everyone's sitting there with their laptops, there's a big screen behind you, it's showing, it's your scientific article, you got 22 minutes, there's a short period of time for questions and answers, and then anyone wants to meet you, they meet you in the hallway to discuss anything you might have found interesting. So I was supposed to do a paper that had been accepted and published on a particular venue I had done in a health support group, with remarkable results in reversing menopause symptoms in all the women in this group, over 287 women. In any case, I didn't do that. I surprise them. I bring out Jonathan. I bring out 3 people who have been on protocols. One had reversed hepatitis B and herpes 1 and 2 and breast cancer and ovarian cancer. Another person reversed their Alzheimer's substantially, and another person had reversed autism. And they were clueless. They didn't know who these people were. And I talked to them. You know, and I said, Jonathan, what you got your hand? He had some outstanding student of the week or the month, and from a very respected school, an advanced school, not for mentally challenged people, regular students in advanced school, and he was doing great. And so afterwards, I said, and here's the interesting thing. I've been sitting here all morning listening to the different reports, and good reports, where people want millions of dollars so they can do stem cell research to correct some mitochondrial dysfunction in the gut or the brain of... And here's whole person, didn't use any stem cells, a whole human being completely cured. Can you handle that? And about 600 people came out in the hallway, so many that we had to get up on chairs just to be able to yell out the answers to all these people. They were fascinated by the people and the medical records we had, you know, that... Not a single doctor or scientist who was there ever followed up to see what, how I did it. Not one. So if you think that because you have something that's new and revolutionary that can help people and has, but it's as simple as diet and lifestyle and behavior, and they're dealing in the complexities of pharmacology, they're not going to accept it. The medical community is not an open forum. It is not democracy. We have massive fascism guiding our medical model. I'll get to that in a moment. So anyhow, so they are wrong when they say that there's no proof. We have proof, absolute irrefutable proof. Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, multiple sclerosis, you name it, but they can handle that. Remember Jack Nicholson a few good minutes? You can't handle the truth. A lot of people can. They can't. So good for them for doing the research. And now I'm going to deal with something else. It's the most current controversy. It deals with saying, all of you who are trying coconut oil, you shouldn't. It's a saturated fat, which is bad for your heart. As we know, as is an absolute truth, ask any doctor, any scientist, any public health official, any dietitian, nutritionist. Saturated fat should be avoided like the plague. They cause your cholesterol to go up. They cause triglycerides to go up. They cause fibrinogen to go up. They cause C-reactive protein to go up. All markers of inflammation of the heart, they can kill you and do. And therefore, thank goodness, we have margarine and corn oil and canola oil and peanut oil. Thank goodness. But they're wrong. They're dead wrong, except they're not the ones dying. Unfortunately, the patients who believe this propaganda for the last 60 years have suffered. So they say there's no science. Well, they're right. There's absolutely no science that they have read. They're wrong. We have read it. So let us show you what doesn't exist. From Indiana University, quote, coconut water is widely consumed in many countries as a refreshing beverage, but its unique chemical composition of electrolytes and nutrients can make for a good natural substitute for sports. That's not the oil, but there are oils in there. This is from University of Warwick. Coconut oil can combat tooth decay. This is from the Canadian Science, the National Research Council, which is equivalent to our National Academy of Sciences, the highest body in Canada. Beating high blood pressure with a combination of coconut oil and physical exercise. Then we have this from Tufts University, Health Science Campus. Coconut oil can control overgrowth of a fungal pathogen in the GI tract. That's probably yeast. Quote, coconut oil controlled the overgrowth of a fungal pathogen called, there it is, Candida albicans. In mice, new research shows in humans, high levels of the Candida albicans in the gastrointestinal tract can lead to bloodstream infections, including invasive candidiasis. Research suggests that it might be possible to use dietary approaches. And there's your coconut oil. And this is from Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine. They're a good group, by the way. Quote, physicians analyze food trends and publish dietary prescriptions for optimal health heart. Well, there again is dealing with cholesterol, coconut oil. Then we have in your heart. This is University College Hospital. Quote, in vitro antimicrobial properties of coconut oil. Okay, then we have University of Putra in Malaysia. Antioxidant capacity and phenolic acid of coconut oil. And talking about what it does and all of its different components in the body. All good. This is from neurobiology of aging, brain boosting. This study showed that the administration of medium-chain triglycerides, that's coconut oil, in subjects with Alzheimer's disease or mild cognitive impairment resulted in significant increases in ketone bodies within only 90 minutes of treatment associated with measurable cognitive improvement in those with less severe cognitive dysfunction. And that was in Neurobiology and Aging. And then we have Wound Healing. And this was in Skin Pharmacology and Physiology. Coconut oil has been used for wound healing since time immemorial. Three of the identified mechanisms behind these healing effects are its ability to accelerate and re-epithelialize improved antioxidant enzyme activity and stimulate higher collagen cross-linkage within the tissue being repaired. Imagine all the millions of people worldwide who suffer burns, and this helps. Then we have the Indian Journal of Pharmacology. Coconut oil has been used synergistically and with traditional treatments to speed burn wound recovery. That's a separate article. Then we have the Indian Journal of Pharmacology, and it also talks about how it helps with skin. Then the pharmaceutical biology. Coconut oil has been demonstrated to have an anti-inflammatory. There's turning off Alzheimer's, dementia, and your brain helping, because if you have inflammation in the brain, you're far more susceptible to brain diseases. If you have inflammation in the heart, heart disease. Inflammation in the lung, emphysema, asthma, pulmonary conditions. In the liver, in the kidneys. So just imagine how valuable coconut oil is in turning off inflammation. Remember, if it turns off inflammation in one organ, it can turn off inflammation in every organ. And then we have the phytotherapy research. Coconut oil here had anti-ulcerogenic effects, helps with ulcers. This is from the physiotherapy research testosterone booster. Quote, coconut oil was found to reduce oxidative stress. That's one of the reasons we age. And resulting in significant higher testosterone levels, which a lot of men and women need. Also, reducing swollen prostate. This came from the Journal of Pharmacy and Pharmaceuticals. Coconut oil has been found to reduce testosterone-induced benign prostatic growth in these experiments. And here is from the peer-reviewed journal Lipids. Improved blood lipids. Now, here's the interesting part. On the one hand, they're saying don't use coconut oil because it's a fat, a saturated fat. And I'm saying this fat, coconut oil, helps bring down the other fats in the body. If these people who made these announcements actually were real scientists or were doing real basic science, they would go to the peer-reviewed literature and see that coconut oil consistently improves the LDL-HDL ratio in the blood of those, quote, who consume it. Given this effect, coconut oil can no longer be dismissed for being that saturated fat which clogs the arteries. Effects of dietary coconut oil on the biochemical and anthropogenic profiles of women presenting abdominal obesity. We also have here from the Agriculture Food Chemistry, fat-soluble nutrient absorption, meaning if you were to take coconut oil and then you were to take curcumin, you get a higher level of absorption of one of the world's most important anti-inflammatory, anti-cancer agents, curcumin. If you take curcumin by itself, you don't get the same quality absorption as if you take it with coconut oil. And I'll give one more here. This is from European publication dealing with oxidative stress and bone health. Quote, coconut oil has been shown to reduce oxidative stress within the bone, which may prevent structural damage and osteoporotic bone. And it talks about, then gives all the scientists and the publications. So those are just a sample. So we have two realities, and that's what we always share on this program. You have the official reality, the orthodox reality, then you have the real reality. So they're on a witch hunt. Just don't buy into their lies. I'm Gary Nall. We're here to talk about the things that make a difference. Now I'm going to share with you a video clip that is done by a medical doctor, board-certified physician, and all the people you're going to hear, every person is a board-certified physician. These are all physicians in a great documentary that was done about heart disease. It's in two parts. I'm only going to play for time reasons because we have so much to do today.
We've been told that medications to lower cholesterol will save lives.
We repeatedly hear from patients that their doctors tell them, if you don't take this, you will die.
Over 40 million people worldwide take drugs to lower their cholesterol. But now there's evidence that the majority of them won't benefit.
None of those people are less likely to die.
I speak to doctors accusing the drug companies of distorting the evidence about the drug's side effects.
Of course they're going to try to minimize the adverse events because that will increase the sales of their drugs.
In its effect, it's certainly scientific fraud, and in its effect, it's organized crime.
So how do these drugs work, and are they really safe? I've come to the United States to investigate how drugs to lower cholesterol came to be the most widely prescribed drugs in the history of medicine.
The marketing concentrates on the fact that you can lower your cholesterol as if that was the end in itself, which it is not. Cholesterol is just a lab number. You know, who cares about lowering cholesterol unless it actually translates into a benefit to patients?
Over the decades, drug companies have had an enormous vested interest in statin drugs.
It's the most profitable group of drugs in the history of the world. Something like 15 to 25 billion, with a B, dollars per year spent on these drugs. So that's higher than the gross national product of many countries around the world.
Lipitor is the best-selling drug in history. So in terms of costs, total sales of Lipitor have been in the range of $140 billion since it came on the market in 1996.
Statins work by disabling a critical step early in the formation of cholesterol.
There's a pathway that produces cholesterol in the body. You can think of it like a tree. So we have decided collectively that one of the branches of this tree is bad, meaning cholesterol. So we've decided that the best way to get rid of that branch is to cut the tree off at the root.
Statins inhibit this enzyme, which is also required for essential molecules like coenzyme Q10. Nutritionist Dr. Johnny Bowden says CoQ10 is essential for optimal heart muscle function.
This is partly, we believe, why so many side effects have to do with lack of energy, muscle pain, because coenzyme Q10 is so vital. So what's the irony of giving people a drug to reduce something that probably doesn't even have that much to do with heart disease that also reduces one of the molecules that's most necessary for heart health? How insane is that?
It's assumed that cholesterol is a toxic substance in your body, and getting it as low as you can is a good thing. Well, cholesterol is the organic molecule that's most common in your brain by weight. It's in every cell wall. It's the precursor of many of the hormones in our bodies. It's an enormously complex molecule. And to think that you can radically pull this out of the body and not have consequences is just, it's ridiculous. It's such bad science.
It's been about 30 years since statins were first introduced as the new blockbuster drug in heart disease, and millions of people around the world are being prescribed these medications. But many are concerned that the benefits of these drugs have been grossly exaggerated. Professor Rita Redberg is a world-renowned cardiologist. She says barring a genetic condition, the only people who live longer by taking a statin of those that have already had a heart attack or stroke.
Valve's working great.
That's good.
Yeah.
And of them, only a very small number will benefit.
One or two people in 100 will benefit from taking a statin. What people don't understand is that means the other 98 will get no benefit at all. It's not going to reduce their chance of dying.
But this hasn't limited their use. These drugs are now being widely prescribed to relatively healthy people, those without diagnosed heart disease. And Dr. Redberg warns most of them won't benefit.
For healthy people, even people that have a lot of risk factors, so they might have high blood pressure, they might smoke, they might have diabetes, the data is not there to suggest that those people are better off taking a statin. No, I don't think it's a wonder drug.
What's your chance of a heart attack or stroke?
But Dr. David Sullivan disagrees. He says all risk factors should be considered.
All right. Now, the reason I'm playing some of this today is because I want you to be able to see some of the motivation behind attacking coenzyme Q10 or ubiquinol or attacking coconut oil, because these are shown to actually benefit the body. So if you have a lot of people starting to make healthy moves in being more self-sufficient in their healthy choices, so they're not going to have unhealthy cholesterol, then those are not customers in the future. A healthy person doesn't need statins or beta blockers. So I see a lot of politics and economics hidden behind this whole anti-coconut campaign and a lot of the other supplement campaigns that have gone on as well. We're going to take a break right now because we switch over during the program for those who just want the health and nutrition part of it. And then now we go into other issues, including when we come back, I'm going to deal with what's wrong with our current model for healthcare, what could take its place, it's better. And then we're going to have Jack Rasmus talking about why the entire economic model in the United States is a fraud. And everything you hear all these economists saying on television are lies or they're very stupid. One or the other. Back in a moment. Please stay with us.
Well, you know you make me wanna shout, kick my heels up and shout, throw my hands up and shout, throw my head back and shout. Come on now, don't forget to say you will. Don't forget to say yeah, 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 yeah.
Say you will.
Say it right now, baby.
Say you will.
Come on, say, come on.
Say you will.
Say it better, yeah.
Say you will.
Come on now,
say that you love me.
I'd like to welcome all of you who are just joining us. I'm Gary Knoll, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios in New York City. You can go to my Facebook page and watch this. You can go to Progressive Reader Network and watch it, or you can just listen on all the stations right now that you normally would be listening to if you don't have access to the internet. I also want to mention that 6 times a week I broadcast, Monday through Friday, noon to 1, and then Eastern Standard Time, and Tuesday evening, 7 to 8. The most powerful hour of the week is the Tuesday evening, the Progressive Commentary Hour. One topic, generally one or two guests, hard-hitting, and just brutally honest. So you won't want to miss that. Now, a lot of people are not around our conventional, what we call terrestrial-based station, a regular radio, so they might be out and about. All right? If you are, let me give you a number. You can call over any listening device and listen to the radio. So no matter where you're at in Canada or United States, both of which are North America, you can listen live. And our phone number, let's see, I'll give you the phone number here in a second to call in live. And then if you miss it and want to listen on the archives, I'll give you an archive number as well to do that. And then we're going to get into what's wrong with our system. Listen live, 712-775-6850, 712-775-6850. Or archiving any program. You can archive up to 5 programs at a time. 701-719-9976. 701-719-9976. And as of today, I'm announcing that I'm going to do a 4-week health support group meeting on Saturdays, 3 to 5 in the afternoon in Manhattan. I'm limiting it to a number of people. This will be a new study group. I'll be there every week. I'm going to be doing the lectures and helping people. It's for people with arthritis, diabetic, or overweight, those 3 conditions. You must have one of those or more of those conditions to qualify to get into the health support group. If you want to be a part of that, you'll call 646-926-5422, 646-926-5422. This will be the only health support group I'll be doing for the year, and I'll be doing it 4 Saturdays in a row, starting with the 1st of July, and then the next 3 Saturdays. And it's a health support group. The whole intent is to help change diet, lifestyle, behavior, so that you no longer suffer from any of these conditions and you regain your optimal wellness. Now, we have a big problem. It's a $3.3 trillion problem and growing. And that's our medical industrial complex. First, stop the whole idea that somehow Obamacare should be kept. It was created, written completely by the insurance industry to serve the insurance industry's interest. It made them $1 trillion. Or that somehow a newfangled concept that the people around Trump will create They're clueless about everything. Ask a basic question. What is the whole purpose of a healthcare system? It is to keep you healthy. Is there anything in our current healthcare system that promotes health? The answer is no. Zero. Not a thing. Not the Surgeon General. Have you even seen the Surgeon General? Have you ever heard the Surgeon General? Do you know if it's a man or a woman? Do you know what their principles are? No. No, you don't. Does the FDA, the CDC, the U.S. Public Health Service, does any government agency actually promote health? The answer is no. Their only idea of health is get a vaccine, and that's a complete fraud. So we have an interest in health, but we don't promote health. We promote disease. Virtually everything we do, and I mean everything we do, promotes disease. When we watch an athletic sport, we're encouraged to buy chicken wings or bacon with cheese on a burger. A double burger with French fries on the burger and buns, an absolute mess for our body. We're told to drink alcohol, either beer if you're a regular person, or some kind of hard alcohol like a vodka, and the taste of vodka. There is no taste of vodka. Vodka is tasteless. It's stupid how we allow ourselves to be manipulated in this, but we do get manipulated. As a result, we're the sickest nation in the history of the world per population. We have more obese children. We have more obese adults than China or India as a population. So surely then, if we're spending all this money that no one's questioning, no one ever questions the hospitals, profit or nonprofit, the universities, Harvard Medical School, the enormous amounts of grants that go out, no one questions it because clearly these are the best and brightest. Okay, well, let's just see how well the best and brightest does. Let's just put them to this. My notion in life is simple. I'm focused on results, not effort. Effort is meaningless. If you never get results, then you can live within your effort and keep making excuses why you have to have more effort. Well, after 45 years of a war on cancer, you have failed miserably. After a 60-year war on heart disease, you failed. A war on mental illness, you failed. We end up with these wars, the war on poverty. Well, that didn't help. The war on drugs. That was an asinine war. So what we have is heart disease. Here's how many people will die this year. 614,000. Cancer, 592,000. From medical errors that are in hospitals and mainly from drugs, 250,000. From chronic lower respiratory, 147,000 from accidents. Unintentional injuries, 136,000. Stroke, about 133,000. Alzheimer's, 94,000. Diabetes, 77,000. Nephritis and neuropathic symptoms, 48,000. Intentional self-harm, 42,000. Here's what it cost. Neurological disease, $800 billion. That's because they've been able to pathologize normal behavior. And no one said a word when they were doing it. The doctors didn't. The institutions didn't. The neurologists didn't. The psychologists didn't. Everyone who profits by telling little Johnny that he's got ADD because he's distracted in the class, they never ask little Johnny's parents, was he fed last night? Caffeine in a beverage, sugar? Did he sleep well or not? Is he bored with the class or not? No. Did he have any kind of vaccine injury or not? No, it's just, Johnny, don't look out the window. Don't stand up. Don't blurt out an answer unless you're asked. You have ADD. So now we have managed to get $800 billion a year, more than heart disease and cancer combined, into the pockets of medical clinicians and hospitals because of the fraud of that entire mental health system. But then we have heart disease, $316 billion. Alzheimer's, $259 billion. Diabetes, $245 billion. We have cancer, $172 billion. And stroke, $33 billion. Medical error, $17 billion. And the number one cause of all disease, number one cause of all death and injury, iatrogenesis. More people will die this year because of improper medicine. Over 80,000 will die because of ulcerations or infections in hospitals, both of which can be prevented. But they're not even counted in there. Almost up to 50,000 could die of malnutrition they got from being in the hospital. Those won't be counted either. So then here is the question that we're faced with. Why are we continuing to call it a medical, a healthcare system when it doesn't help our health? And then let's just say that you had Obamacare or you had any other care. Do they actually work? And I'm just showing you they don't work. So we're not even questioning if your insurance is paying or you pay out of your pocket or copay, are you actually getting quality care that can prevent you from dying and reverse your condition? The answer is none of the above. Where we do excel, where we do have good medicine, is emergency medicine. If you get a finger cut off, if you get your teeth knocked out, if you have a stroke, if you have, if you need a transplant, we're good at that. And I commend medicine on that. Everything else, which represents 80%, we fail. It's all about the profit. Take the profit out of medicine. You could do that by having universal health care and start off with having prevention. You want to be a part of this where there's no copays? Then it's simple. Get rid of all the administrative costs, which you wouldn't have to have if you had universal health care. That saves you $1 trillion. Get rid of all the defensive medicine. That saves you about $300 billion. Get rid of medical malpractice. Have universal malpractice where you are compensated but not excessively, and the doctor doesn't end up going broke by paying excessive amount of medication or for the insurance. Also, have quality time with a physician so you're not just going in and out of office getting prescriptions. Make sure that in this system you have alternative medicine offered and represented. Naturopathic medicine, homeopathy, things like chelation, vitamin C, chiropractic. So a person goes in, they see the full spectrum of what is capable in helping to heal. And then you don't profit. Don't let oncologists profit by buying a chemotherapy for $5,000, selling it to you for $12,000, and keeping $7,000 for themselves. And that doesn't even include the cost of hospitalization. If you take the profit out of it and you make it preventative and you give people an education in the process and you open up public health clinics in every town and community in America to get people to prevent disease, so you have weight control clinics, you have de-stress clinics, you have places where you can get off drugs and opiates, you show natural painkillers. It would cost us under $1 trillion a year. We're now paying $3.3 trillion. We would save at least $2.5 trillion a year. And we would save lives. We would prevent disease because we'd be teaching something that industry could not control and would have no say-so in. And as we get the dairy industry out, the sugar industry out, we get the lobbyists for the meat industry, the chicken and poultry industry, and the pharmaceuticals out to show people what constitutes a healthy choice with good science, with good people who are not industry affiliated, we could prevent disease, help the people with the best real treatments of disease, get rid of the FDA completely, get rid of the National Institutes of Health, get rid of the National Cancer Institute, get rid of all the federal agencies, and in its place put one single entity that is there to give the best science and have people who are not affiliated, who are highly ethical, physicians, nurses, public health advocates, overseeing all this. And you would completely turn it around. That's doable. Everything I just said is documented and doable. Everything they're talking about, well, it's just pixie dust by idiots. Let's go to my guest standing by, Dr. Jack Rasmus. You hear his show because it's on the Progressive Radio Network every Friday at 2 p.m. And Jack is a professor of political economics at St. Mary's College and Santa Clara University in California. And he was an economic analyst for several global corporations before he became an academic. And he is the author of Central Bankers at the End of Their Ropes, Monetary Policy in the Next Generation. Nice to have you with us today, Jack.
My pleasure.
Jack, I'm concerned that people are not aware of how much debt we have and the fact that we are, quite simply, we are literally bankrupt. And we are not talking about this anywhere. We don't talk about our different types of debt, but I did the latest statistics, Jack, and I'd like for you to take this. We have a gross domestic product of $19 trillion. And that's not even real because a lot of that's Wall Street money, up to 12%, and that doesn't circulate in the rest of the community. They're not building factories. They're not hiring people for jobs. It's all self-contained. The U.S. debt, total debt is $67.5 trillion. The national debt is $19.9 trillion. U.S. federal spending is $3.9. State debt is $1.2 trillion. Local debt is $1.9 trillion. The interest paid on debt is $2.5 trillion. The total personal debt is $18.3 trillion. Mortgage debt is $14.5 trillion. Student debt is $1.5 trillion. Credit card debt is $1 trillion. Car loan debt is $1 trillion. Unfunded entitlements, $106 trillion. Corporate debt, $6 trillion, and our unemployment is actually closer between 22 and 24%. Why aren't any American economists talking about this and telling people that our economic model has failed miserably and we must change to something more sustainable and viable? The forum is yours.
Well, the economists don't talk about it because the economists, if they did, would not be able to promote their careers very much longer. You know, you talk about debt globally. We've increased debt $50 trillion since 2009. Now, people need to remember that that debt problem in 2007-08 and now today is primarily private debt, and it's primarily corporate debt. It's a, you know, household debt has risen and government debt has risen. But that's more of the consequence of the problem of the economic system. It's not really the cause of these crises that we have, like 2008-09 and the next one that's coming here in not too distant future. Most of it, again, is corporate debt, business debt, non-financial and non-financial business debt. Whether it's outside the U.S. or inside the U.S., that is the primary problem. Now, it's not just debt alone, level of debt, that's the problem. People don't quite understand that. It's not just how high the debt level has gotten, which it is right back to where it was. It's how fast that debt has increased. And most important, to what extent has income increased in order to service that debt. In other words, pay the principal and interest on that debt. You get into crises where the income does not rise to service the debt as fast as the leverage or the debt itself is rising. And then you start getting defaults, and now you got a credit cycle crash, and you got a problem. So it's income as well as the ability to pay the rising debt. As long as prices keep rising, then you can pay the debt. Now, business prices have continued to rise in the financial sector. I'm talking about stocks and bonds and derivatives and foreign exchange and all these other financial asset markets. The prices have risen, so you can raise the debt as long as the prices rise. Now, you get crises when the prices stop rising and they start collapsing. Then you're in trouble. Household debt is in trouble because it is rising, but the prices aren't rising. What do we mean prices? We mean wages. Wages are just the price of labor. So if wages aren't rising, but as you said, we got a $1.5 trillion student debt, very fast rate of increase in student debt. We have $1.2 trillion auto debt, fast increase in auto debt, and now $1 trillion in credit card debt. Also, housing debt is rising again. Housing prices, we got a bubble again, both in the residential side, according to Vice Chairman Stanley Fischer of the Fed, and also on the commercial property side, which is already unwinding. So we got four big household consumer debt bubbles building here. But at the same time, we have corporate debt a problem in the junk bond sector, and $4 trillion of junk bond and investment bond debt are at risk here, according to the IMF. So we have these, and stocks are in a bubble, especially the tech stocks, again, over 20% increase in the last 6-7 months. So we got bubbles in stocks, we got bubbles in junk bond, we got bubbles in housing and student and auto and so forth. In Europe, they got a problem with $1.5 trillion in non-performing bank loans, $2 trillion non-performing bank loans in Japan, 5 to 7 trillion non-performing bank loans in China. In other words, corporations that have borrowed money from banks are not paying it back, especially in these other economies outside the U.S. That's a sign of a bubble. It's not just the level of debt, to summarize. It's the income that's been rising or not, and it's the default rate that begins to emerge when you got a bubble that's about to crash.
Thank you, Jack, for that. By the way, to a lot of our stations, they'll be signing off now, but we are continuing on Facebook and also Progressive Radio Network. Jack, when you look at all of the bubbles, it is clear and unequivocal, in my opinion, that these bubbles are going to begin to burst and there will be a cascading effect. And because if corporations cannot service their debt and they have to foreclose or go bankrupt, then the people who have credit cards, car payments, student loans, who work in that company can no longer afford that. And you're going to see personal bankruptcy increase also. That brings down a whole area of the economy. Then people don't have disposable income, and then those restaurants and dry cleaners and other places that rely upon the local neighbors coming in and using their services, they're going to close. So there's going to be a chain reaction here that I see happening, and I believe it's going to be start to unwind. Everything's going to start to unwind within the next 24 months. What do you see?
Well, it could very well, because the bubbles are growing to close to unsustainable levels. But remember again, what precipitates the crash and the credit crash and the downturn happens in the private sector, happens in the corporate sector. They can't sustain payments of that debt level. And when they can't, they start defaulting. You get financial and corporate and financial defaults start the whole chain reaction. When corporations can't pay their debt levels, let's say that their income growth, as you see with the junk bond corporations, is no longer sufficient to pay the principal and interest on the debt that they've been borrowing to try to stay alive as zombie companies. When that happens, they start laying off people. You start getting layoffs and mass layoffs and they're cutting costs in general. Now, when that happens, you've got a workforce, maybe over 120 of the 155 million people in the U.S., a workforce that is very fragile. They haven't been getting income increases. They're struggling. They're working part-time, temporary. They're paying more for their benefits than they ever had before as we get all the privatization going on and pensions and healthcare and so forth. And then they get laid off, so they start defaulting on their student debt, on their auto debt, on their housing debt, so forth. So the crisis starts in the corporate sector, and then it spills over from the financial to the non-financial corporate, and then it spills over to the rest of the economy. And as you get a collapse and defaults in housing, two things happen. The government has to step in and add more debt to bail out both the corporations and the households. So the debt, in a sense, gets transferred from private sector, households and corporations, to the government balance sheet. So government debt is a consequence of the bigger problem of private sector debt. And private sector debt primarily begins in the corporate sector. It happened that way in 2008-09, and it's going to happen that way once again. So you got to watch the bubbles out there and see which ones bust when. It could be U.S. housing stocks. It could be junk bonds. It could be non-performing loans in China and Europe. Stock market leverage. The debt in the stock market is at record levels again. Margin buying, in other words, I'm buying more stocks based on borrowing money. That's bigger than it was in 2009 and 10. So you got debt-driven prices, you see. It's not just the price level, but how fast and how much debt is driving that price level. And in those places, those examples, I've given an example to you, it's a question of debt-driven price bubbles. IMF has recently said 10% of U.S. corporations are in trouble. That's a big number, 10%, right? And they've added $8 trillion in debt since 2010, just on the corporate side. And half of that is weak and susceptible to a crash. So what you got to do is watch the default rates. And that tells you who is not able to pay that debt because their income is not rising anymore. Cash flow is the income on the corporate side, not rising anymore. Disposable income on the household side, not rising and hasn't been rising for some time. Households take on more debt because their income isn't growing. So they add debt to pay debt. But at some point, they don't get the loans, you see. They don't. The banks won't turn over and give you more debt to pay the old debt. And then you're in trouble. Then you have the big contraction. So you got to watch those markets that are in bubbles and watch the default rate and watch whether banks are rolling over the existing debt.
Jack, what I'd like to do is invite you back for a progressive commentary hour for the whole hour, because we need to show people, and it's not that difficult, how to get out of debt and stay out so that they're not tied on with that rope around their waist when everyone else and the corporations and people go off the cliff, they're not going with them. So if you're available within 3 weeks, we will, Richard Gale will get in touch with you, our executive producer, and we'll get you back into a whole hour continuing our discussion.
Yes, and I think by then, you know, my forthcoming book, Central Bank Book, Critique of Central Banks, how they're really responsible for a lot of this in the long run.
Great.
We'll be out. We can talk about that as well.
Okay, good. Today, we just wanted to inform people we're threatened by bubbles. They're everywhere. They're not going away. They're going to collapse. I don't want people to be adversely affected. And Dr. Jack Rasmus, who is an economist. He's a professor of political economics, St. Mary's College, Santa Clara University in California. And he is the author of Central Bankers at the End of Their Ropes. He'll be back for a full hour. I'm Gary Nall. We're out of time. I want to thank you all for listening. Look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Now, stay tuned for Yutrice Lead. She'll be here in just about 60 seconds, and she'll have a full 55-minute program for you.